going to ask Steve some questions that maybe will spur some questions for y'all as well, and then kind of walk around and you can ask your questions about anything that you might want to ask our pastor. And so, Steve, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We kind of have a small group today because of the weather, but we will. It's always a good program. Everybody always wants to talk to you and ask you tough questions.
Well, we always find out who are the hardy folks. When the weather's bad and who shows up, then you know.
Yeah. Well, they're that, and they got a good, robust meal today, too. So talk to us a little bit. I want to go backwards, look backwards first, and then kind of move forward. Talk to us a little bit about Advent this year, kind of how that played out in terms of whether it's your preaching or attendance or music or just something that you remember and that stands out for you, and then maybe even more close to the end of the year, the fact that we made budget, and I know that's an exciting thing. Talk to us about the end of the year of 2022.
Yeah, well, I just think Advent's the most glorious time of the year at South Main. The sanctuary is never more beautiful. College kids are coming back. Feels like families are back together. I think Adam's just doing a spectacular job with the music. We had, you know, 50 to 60 in the choir every week. The music was glorious. It was just such a wonderful season. And I do think that helps us as we're trying to get to the end of the year. I've looked at our giving in the month of December, and we've increased over the last 4 years from steadily, consistently giving about $1.2 million in December to $1.45 million in December. But $1.1 million of that $1.45 million came in the last 6 days of the year. So that's 25% of the budget came in the last six of the 365 days of the year. So, that keeps sliding farther and farther back into the year. But we've made it. So it's amazing. It's just a little bit nerve-wracking. Part of the reason why we've built over the course of the last 12 years an operating reserve that is now like $1,060,000. Greg Taylor, who's the finance chair, said last night at the deacons meeting, don't think of that as the operating reserve. Think of it as our working capital, because we start the year with that money in the bank, and then we spend it down during the course of the year, but we don't have to have a line of credit. We're not borrowing money and paying interest. And then at the end of the year, we fill it back up so it'll be ready for the next year. And that's the adventure ride.
One of the other questions that came up at Deacon's meeting yesterday is about growth.
Yep.
And I know we don't have a ton of data on that, and we're trying to climb back from where we were in COVID. But one of the things that I think you mentioned to me was we do have some really remarkable new givers to the budget that are people that are new to the church.
So there was... we really do. So we've had folks who joined the church. Well, let me back up and say this. It's hard to tell where we are in growth because we're in the midst of just a sea change in people's attending church. The Barna group came out a week or two ago, and they said across America, 61% of Christians stayed in their church through the pandemic. Which is to say, 39% of Christians left the church they had been attending, and some of them have gone someplace else. So we're the beneficiary of some of that. There are folks who, for various reasons, at various churches, were unhappy with where they were. Some churches that are a little more progressive than we are, some churches a little more conservative than we are, but found us online and said, I think that's the kind of place I ought to be. And so we've had some really good folks who I think will be great committee members, capable leaders in the church, who've come and made a church home here. And some of those folks have become key givers. And the reality is that we had a couple of if you look at, we oversubscribed the budget by $135,000, without... just a few families who joined the church in 2021, and so 2022 was their first giving year, we would have undersubscribed the budget. But we have new folks who are giving, And that's making a difference. The other thing I think about that, though, is I remember 20 years ago when I came here and I thought, you know, if it wasn't for Harry Chavon and if it wasn't for Vernon Garrett and if it wasn't for, and you could make a list of about five or seven people, we wouldn't make it. And about two of those folks are still here. It's amazing how as some folks move on or as some folks move up, other folks come in and replenish that. But and every year there's somebody who last year carried an extraordinary share of the burden and something happened this year and they couldn't do that. Somebody else who last year wasn't able to do something and this year something happened. Maybe it's going to recur, maybe it's not, but God seems to find a way to provide for us.
And it is interesting. When we talk about growth, church growth, we always think about numbers.
Yep.
But there's also the growth in the depth of our discipleship that I think we're seeing as well.
So it's a chart that it's a course that we're trying to chart. Like I think there are two things that we have to tend simultaneously. And it's not that I don't think other folks are tending them, but folks tend to land on one side or the other. There, it feels more either or, and we're trying to be both and. So I'm in a text group with about, I guess it's 13 pastors who text a word of encouragement on Sunday morning, all Baptists. And every week it is, you know, I just pray for souls to walk down the aisle. Well, I hope their bodies come with them when they walk down the aisle. It'd be a little unnerving if just the souls did that. But it's like the only measure of is God active in your church is did somebody join this week? And I believe in conversion. I believe in personal decisions. I believe we got to be baptizing people. We want new people to come to faith in Christ Jesus. But the other side of that is, are we manifesting the kingdom? Are we studying the Bible well? Are we trying to do the things in our daily lives? Are we being good neighbors? Are we being fair with the people we work with or who work for us? Are we being gracious to the people around us? Are we advocating for people who don't have a voice in a way that's consistent with what God wants for the world? And I think there are a set of churches that seems to be all they talk about, and they don't much care about who's coming in. But we have to do both of those at once, and that's the more complicated way to do church.
Yeah, and talk to us a little bit just about last weekend about Esau Macaulay. I think one of those things is to begin to see things maybe that we haven't seen before, or to see different perspectives and therefore move out into the world sort of in a new way as well. Talk to us about what you thought of last weekend.
So I really was just happy with everything Esau did. If you weren't able to be here, those things are his three presentations will be on our website. And you ought to go take a look. Candidly, I thought he did a great job Saturday night addressing publicly, like the lecture on policing. Somebody said to me that was very South Main. It was a Bible study. I said right. I thought he did a better job preaching on Sunday morning than he did lecturing on Saturday night. And I thought he did a better job still in the fellowship hall than he did. Every time he spoke, he seemed to get better. Part of what I like about that is we weren't trying to solve the problem. We weren't trying to get the sum at the end, and now we know the answer, and it's all going to be better. And I thought that's one of the things he said so incredibly well here in the fellowship hall is he said, you know, justice is this topic that some Christians want to say, I've already heard that. I don't want to do it anymore. He said, nobody says, well, we talked about parenting a decade ago, so we don't need to do that anymore. Or we talked about being a good spouse when I got married, and I don't have to work on that anymore. All of our discipleship is an ongoing process. And so I think one of the gifts that we get to give not only to each other but to the whole city is to bring in really thoughtful people who will, from a biblical perspective, say, here's what I think this says, and here's what it calls us to, and this is hard, and we got to work on it together. And then we can work on it together, but that's going to take some time. I just thought he did that really well.
And I know we have some other speakers coming in. If you want to save that yep. for Sunday.
No. I'm really excited. I want to tell you about that. So I became aware of Esau Macaulay in August of 2020. We had just finished writing the Mayor's Task Force on Police Reform. I was the lead writer for the theological section for that. Spent about 2 months trying to get it done. We worked really hard on it. And about 2 weeks after we turned it in, his book, Reading While Black, came out. And I read it, and I thought, oh, I just feel so stupid. Like, if I had only known, I could have thrown away 2 months of our work, and we just used his chapter and said, this is the answer. So I've been inviting him since then to come, and I'm really excited. And at some point, I thought, and let me just be candid, I want to make sure we're balanced in how we present things. Now, I'm going to invite people that I think are right down the middle in their biblical presentation. But someone will say, oh, he's going to talk about justice things. He's a little more progressive. I'm not sure that's right, but it's, you know, someone will say that. So I thought we need to have somebody who will balance, and they'll say, he's going to talk about biblical things, but he's a little more conservative. And during the pandemic, Greg actually introduced me to a writer that I have read 2-3 times a week for the last 3 years. His name is David French. And David French is just, he's an amazingly thoughtful person. And all of us have a unique story. Let me just give you some of the contours of his. He grew up in a little town in Tennessee, very conservative religious family. Went to a Presbyterian college and then to Harvard Law School. He became a litigator. He made his career suing universities over speech codes. It was sort of the conservative right, free speech stuff. When we went to war in Iraq, he said, hey, if we're going to say support our troops, you got to be willing to be one of them. So he went into the Army as a JAG officer and was deployed to Iraq. He tells the story that he had no way to know it at the time, but the most frightening night of his life was under attack in Iraq. It happened to be the same night that the daughter he would later adopt was born in Ethiopia. So he and his wife later decided to adopt an African girl. He was in that sort of conservative space, and he said the media world has become just a chamber for being angry. And I want to write thoughtfully and unanxiously and with some depth. I want to find people who really are content experts to write and say, here's some things you should know about what's happening today in the world. So he and some friends actually started a new media group called The Dispatch, which I read their morning summary every day. And he's just been stolen away from them by the New York Times. He'll write a column twice a week for the New York Times starting next month. Well, he's going to come talk to us in September. And just about how should Christians productively engage in the world in a way that can draw people in rather than pushing them out. I can't tell you how many times in the last 3 years somebody has asked me, either somebody more progressive or somebody more conservative, I'm losing the ability to talk to people in my own family. Is there something we can do that will bring us together? And I think he's going to be a good voice for that. The third one in between we just had drop in our lap. You hear more Tom Wright than you know, and you know a lot. But N.T. Wright is the premier New Testament scholar in the world. He's now in his mid-70s. He lives in England. And there have been a group of folks who are trying to bring him to the United States about once a year, and they decided we should go to Houston. There are two airports. There's plenty of hotel space. There's plenty of places to eat. But where could we host 500 or 600 pastors from around the world who'd want to come hear Tom Wright? And the great news for us is they asked Todd Still that question, and he said, you should ask South Main Baptist Church. So we're going to have him here June 4th to the 7th. It'll be really be an event for pastors. I'm hoping he's going to preach here on June the 4th. He is recovering from long COVID and has had a rough time of that. And so it'll be closer to that time before we'll know if he has the energy to preach. But I'm hoping that goes well enough that it becomes an annual event for us. I've been trying to get him here for 20 years, and I'm glad to finally get him.
And I know you're a big fan. One of the things that we've talked about, and I think we presented this with the campus master plan, is the idea of the need to continue to grow as a strategic need. Do you think bringing these speakers in plays a role maybe in that?
I really do. You know, we had people who's only who they saw it on social media, or they drove past the church and saw a billboard and came here to see Esau McCauley. And several of those folks came up to me to say, thank you for hosting this. And my goodness, this place is beautiful. I said, yeah. And the buildings are nice, too. You got to come back tomorrow and be here on a Sunday. And so it was an opportunity to invite people in. It's also an opportunity just to plant seeds that this is the kind of place where really thoughtful discussion takes place about things that matter in your daily life. And I think that is generative.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting now, especially that David French writes for the New York Times and Esau writes for the New York Times, and not everybody reads the New York Times, but it would be interesting if you read the New York Times and you drive by this billboard at this church and you saw Esau McCauley, you know, in January, and then a little bit later in the year, you say, oh, David French, Esau, wow, that's interesting.
David French, I was listening to a podcast he hosts called Good Faith. And he was talking about why he decided to leave what he, by his own admission, is his dream job at this news outlet that they've created and moved to the Times. And he said, it's the gold standard of journalism. He said, whether you read it or not, he said they have 8.4 million digital subscribers. They're an order of magnitude larger than the next media outlet. The platform that affords their writers is just unparalleled. And so I think that's right. So we were really, fortunately, Greg knew who he was before anybody else, and we got him at the cheap rate before he went to the New York Times.
Well, speaking of expenditures, talk to us a little bit about the budget. We are going to vote on the budget this week, this Sunday. Brad's going to do a presentation on it Wednesday. Just maybe give us a thumbnail about that or anything else that you want us to be aware of as that approaches.
Yeah, let me say three things about the budget. The first is there is a strength and a weakness to the model we're using to write the budget. And on balance, we think the strength is much greater than the weakness. So here's the strength. We used to write the budget in August, finalize it in August and in early September. We would present it to the deacons in September for them to look at, have a month to think about it, and then ask them to endorse it in October. And then we would vote on it at church in the October business meeting. The problem was, remember before we said 25% of our giving comes in at the end of the year? We had no idea when we were writing the budget whether we were going to meet the budget or not. We didn't know what our health insurance was going to do. In some years, that goes up 20%. You know what our property insurance was going to do? This year, that went up 31%. So we really had to guess with some what are pretty big numbers relative to the whole size of the budget. And we wrote imprecise budgets. So one year, the finance chair said, I don't know why we're doing this. Like, let's just run on autopilot in January. And then we'll wait till we close, like we'll draft the finance committee, the pastoral team starts working on a budget in September, the finance committee starts working on it in October, the mission committee sort of jumps in November, finance committee really starts tuning a little bit in December, and then they come back to finalize. But when we write the budget, we know every expenditure from the prior year, and we know how much money we brought in. And so we're able to write really precise budgets. The strength is we write good budgets. We know what it costs to do the church. The weakness is we have 1 week between the time we finish writing the budget and the time we really need to vote on it. The finance committee finalized the budget a week ago tomorrow. So in a week and a half, we've got to get it finalized. We've got to share it with the deacons. We've got to present it to them. We've got to communicate it to the church and then bring it to the church at a business meeting. And so we're really counting on this being a high trust process. And we know that you don't have much time to absorb that information. Second thing is this budget is different than any budget since I've been at South Main. And you can boil that down to one word, and that word is inflation. Anybody seen a news report in the last week about the cost of eggs? It's like every day there are three reports on what eggs cost. Well, all year long, our budgets have been absorbing that cost, but the church only gets to reset its budget one time a year. And so all of that inflation is going to hit in this budget. The budget is going to grow by a pretty considerable amount, and almost all of that growth can be accounted for by inflation. We're not starting a new ministry. We're not changing substantially the way we're doing the church. This is what it costs us to keep doing church the way we've been doing it. It just is going to cost more. And so there's a real challenge to it this year. And I think there'll be some sticker shock. But Greg Taylor, who's our finance chair, said, let's just go through block by block in our presentations and explain, why does this block cost this much, and what are we doing there? So let me just give you another example. I told you the property insurance went up 31%. We pay the MIT living wage. We pay not less than the MIT living wage to everyone who works at the church. When I say MIT living wage, do you know what I'm talking about? Let me explain that to you. It's a really important thing. So there's a minimum wage, and it hadn't changed in more than a decade. The minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. Anybody here think you could live on $7.25 an hour? So Greg Taylor made a point which I thought was really important. And his point was the minimum wage is really designed for a teenager who's getting their first job and they're sacking groceries at HEB, or they're working at McDonald's, but it is transient kind of work. We have zero employees at South Main Baptist Church that fit that description. We've got child care workers who've been here 25 years. The folks who are going to clean up this room after us and then set it up for Wednesday night, some of them have been here 20 years. All of those folks have to live somewhere in Harris County and pay rent and buy food and all those things. So there's a group in the business school at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and they have online. You can do a web search for MIT living wage, and for every county in America, they will tell you how much you have to make per hour if you work a 40-hour week to live in that county at the minimum level. Now, there are several columns to that if you're just supporting yourself, and that's the one we use. It's the lowest number. If you're a single parent of one child, a single parent of two children, if you're a dual-income family, it'll work its way up. And when we started this, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago, we were paying some folks $8 or $9 an hour, and the MIT living wage was about $10 an hour. And it took us a minute to get everybody up to that. And it might go up 50 cents or 75 cents in a year. That's felt like a big jump. And then from 2020 to 2021, it went up more than a dollar. In 2021 to 2022, it resets in March. It went from $14.33 to, in March of 2022, it jumped up to $15.75. And then for the first time, they reset it again in July to $16.98 an hour. That's an 18.3% increase. But again, that's what we're paying our lowest paid people, and we have an objective standard from a reliable source to say, if you don't make this much, you can't live in this county. And we've committed to paying our folks that. That change by itself will add $85,000 to the budget. That's a 2% increase in the budget. But here's what I hope it buys you. When you go home at night and you wonder, are we taking care of the people who take care of us? The answer is yes. And one of the objective measures for that, back in 2013, when I was working to fight payday lending, I found out, because Brad and Jill told me, that we routinely made loans to our employees, $30, which you could pay back over the next three paychecks, or $50. I need to buy some school supplies for my child, and I can't afford construction paper. or a part broke on my car and I'm going to replace it, but I can't afford to buy the part. They were at such a margin level that any change threw them out. And once we got to the MIT living wage, those loans have virtually stopped because it's a living wage. Anyway, so those things.
Yeah, well, the field that, you know, that's the kind of church that we are. And
that's
the kind of church that we belong to is one that does that. Well, talk to us a little bit about what, and I want to save plenty of time for folks to ask questions. And so, but tell us a little bit about what you're going to preach on the rest of this year. I know we're about to start a new sermon series this week.
So we got next two series coming up. We're going to start what we're going to call I Believe, where we just look at people who blurt out confessions in the Gospels. So people who come to Jesus and either he asks them something and they that elicits a confession of faith. This week, there's a blind man and a mute man, and they say, have mercy on us. And he says, do you believe I'm able to do this? And they said, we believe. So that's a good question for us. Do we believe God is able to meet us in the dailiness of our lives, in the crises we face, and make a difference? That is the beginning point of faith. Next week, we'll get to the fellow whose son's in trouble. And Jesus says, do you believe? And he says, I believe. Help thou my unbelief, which is about the most honest confession of faith ever uttered by anybody. So we'll take 4 weeks and look at those confessions of faith and ask what does that mean for us. And then when we shift to Lent, when we're thinking about Advent and the promises of God being fulfilled, I just love the verse that says, in Jesus all the promises of God are yes. Now we should ask, what are the promises? So we're going to look at times that God made promises in the Old Testament. A promise to Noah, a promise to Abraham, a promise to Moses, a promise to David. Promises that God has made in the Old Testament leading up to Easter, where we can see how have these promises been fulfilled through Jesus and his resurrection. Good. And then after that, we're going to look at the prophet Samuel.
Who?
Samuel.
Samuel. I've heard of him.
Yeah, he's a good one.
And then in June, you've got some study time. Is that right, or is that July?
Okay. July. So in July, I took a sabbatical last summer, and prior to that, I took a sabbatical in 2011. The Lilly Endowment did a large study to find out what makes churches unhealthy. And their number one answer was, their pastors get burned out. And when you get burned out, you do dumb things. And so they asked, what can we do to keep pastors from being burned out? And they said, well, you should give them a sabbatical where they can rest and play and think and come back ready to work again. So they started this grant program for churches. Again, they weren't doing this to be kind to the pastors, although that's a nice byproduct. They were doing it to help churches become healthier. So as we looked at that and the personnel committee, we looked at best practices. We said that ought to happen every 5 years. Well, we made it 11, which is more than five. So what I figured out is I'm bad at doing that, and a sabbatical is frankly really expensive because if I'm gone for 12 weeks, if I'm gone for 4 weeks, we have great voices in-house who can fill the pulpit. If I'm gone for 12 weeks, if it turns out that Greg's got to do 6 memorial services and he's got to preach, that's a lot on Greg. And there's a whole set of things that I do that everybody else has to cover. So I talked with Nancy McNeil and with Kathy Bernal and said, here's what I'd like to propose. Starting in 2023, I'm just going to take the month of July as a study leave. So I'll take off for 4 weeks, and basically I think of that as a couple of reading weeks, a conference week. There's a great conference on preaching at Oxford that black pastors and white pastors go to, led by Joel Gregory and Todd Still, that just feeds my soul. And then I'll plan a year's preaching and then come back. So this will be the first year of those, and I'm going to Oxford for two really simple reasons. The more pressing is because Truett Seminary now has an apartment there, and I can stay there for free. And free works in everybody's budget. And the second reason is because it's Oxford. So
that's great. That's great. Well, I've got more questions, but I want to get to our audience. As we talk, did any question come to mind or something you've been on your mind or heart the last few days or weeks that you wanted to ask Steve? Earl, here you go.
What attracts you to Oxford?
That's a good question, Earl. I didn't know much about Oxford before 2011 when I went, and I just think it's magical. It's a beautiful city. I'm really intrigued by C.S. Lewis, and so when I go, I always read two or three of his books. There's something about being in the place where he wrote that's lovely. The weather tends to be just glorious. It's conducive to reading. If you have watched any of the Harry Potter movies, the rare books room or whatever they call that is actually the Duke Humphrey's reading room at the Bodleian Library, and that's where I go read, and I feel smart when I read there. Also, kidding aside, the preaching conference is there, and because they're the world comes there to share what they know at Oxford. I remember my favorite lecture I got to go to. They just have a list of lectures at the university, and you can just go. And so I remember looking at one, and the title was Change Management in Stressful Times. And I thought, if there is a short definition of pastoral work, that is it. Todd Bolsinger says the definition of leadership is helping people absorb disappointment at a rate, or helping people absorb disappointment at a rate they can absorb. So, change management in stressful times. I thought I should go hear that. It was F.W. de Klerk talking about handing over South Africa to Nelson Mandela. And every day, there's something at that level. Somebody who's just been a world changer who comes to say, "Here's what I learned."
Would Missy go with you? Or what? Tell us about your family. How's your family doing?
So I've convinced Missy to come this year. She's going to come and spend a week and a half. That'll be we're going to take vacation before the study leave starts. The thing I'm most excited about that, we're going to go see Hamilton in London. I want to see how the Brits respond to King George's character in that play. I think it will be different than our response.
Yeah.
But I'm excited to get some time away with Missy. The boys are doing great, and they are both happy. Fisher's birthday was Sunday. He turned 3. Lila is 1. Rachel and Blake are doing great. We've gotten to go up there, although not as much as we'd like to, but it's just delightful to watch them grow. Y'all know what grandkids are. It's just the best.
Two questions. Is Esau up to coming back, like, next year or something? And also, how are things going with the task planning thing?
Yeah, the campus master plan. It's good questions both. Yeah, Esau had a delightful time. Like, it was the Dickens it took us 3 years to get him here. And I hope you heard more than once in his presentations, he said, "Y'all should have me back to talk about this." He wasn't kidding about that. And once he said, "You know what you should do? Y'all should have Charlie and me come." Well, Charlie is Charlie Dates, who's the pastor of the Progressive Baptist Church in Chicago. He's like the Ralph West of Chicago. He said, "Have Charlie come preach and have me come do a Bible study." So we'll look into that and see if it's feasible. But that would be a dynamic duo. But I really do think he'd like to come back. It helps us that his sister, Latasha, who was here, and DeVay, his niece, Latasha is the cardiac intensivist at Memorial Children's Hospital. So she's a high-pressure, high-demand physician. And he hadn't seen his niece because of the pandemic. And so it was like that was really the first time. He said, "We FaceTime all the time, but we hadn't had FaceTime." The campus master plan is, here's where we are. That we needed to get through this weekend and get the budget adopted. That is really absorbed at least Brad's full-time attention and a fair bit of my attention. We'll start next month with the New York consultants, HR&A. Their job is to help us clarify what are our goals for this project, or what are our values, how do those values shape our goals, and how can our land help us meet those goals. There's some really specific things we need to have clarity about before we go hire architects. Because once we hire architects, the burn rate, what does it cost per month for the developers to be working, is like $100,000 a month. So we do not want to waste time once we've started that. So I anticipate about mid-March, we'll activate the Transwestern part of this project, and they will start putting, they will put out requests to various architects across the country, saying, here's what we're trying to accomplish. What would you like to do? And the great news for that is, one, all of those architects will be writing projects for us. We own all their product, and they're bidding to be a part of the project. So whichever one we choose, we get to cherry pick the best ideas from everything that was submitted. But I think that will take the rest of this year.
And I know each of the staff members are playing a role on that effort too, some more than others. But talk to us about the staff. I know it's Jay is doing. I have a lot of interface with Jay, and Jay's doing a tremendous job. I know Dolores's group is all doing well too. Talk to us a little bit about the staff members, and maybe some that maybe aren't quite that folks don't see quite as much.
Sure, let me. I just think we have the best team we've had in the 20 years I've been here. Like, everybody is doing, I think, exceptional work in the places where they are. So let me just run down the hallway from my office. Susan Moore is executive minister. I don't know. I used to tell her what we should put on her business card was utility infielder, because kind of whatever we needed to get done. And that's still true. But let me what it means for her to be executive minister. After the George Floyd Memorial, when I was starting to be asked in the city to do more outwardly facing things, Wade Klein, who was chair of personnel or chair of deacons, and Nancy, no, chair of personnel, and Nancy, who was chair of the deacons, said, "We think your ministry is entering a new phase, and we want to bless that, but you're going to have to let go of some things. Your plate's full. To put something new on it, you got to take something else off of it." And so Susan really is day-to-day making sure the church is operating smoothly. For a long time, she has been the coordination point in our office where the professional staff and support staff and the ministers, if they have a question, they go ask Susan before they ask anybody else. She has a wall of calendars in her office, and more times than I can tell, people just come and sit in there and look at the calendars to see what is everybody else doing. And how is what I'm doing going to coordinate and fit into that? And so that's just incredibly valuable, and it frees me up to do things outside. So I've given a lot of management responsibility up and some leadership responsibility up at the church to Susan, and that frees me to face outwardly more. So that translates into things like when Esau McCauley was here, Kim Ogg, who's the district attorney in Harris County and has a pretty big police trial coming up in the next couple of weeks, came here to hear about policing because we'd had a conversation about what was going to happen. Marcus Cosby, who's the pastor at Wheeler Avenue Baptist Church, and Ralph West at Church Without Walls, and Harvey Clemens at Pleasant Hill Baptist, they were all here because I've had time to tend relationships with all three of them, and that is additive, it's generative to what we can do in the community, and that's enabled because Susan has taken over some stuff that used to be mine to do. Go to the next office down, that's Matt Walton. We do not train people to do adult discipleship in Baptist life anymore. I know that's crazy because, like, the genius of Baptist church is Sunday school, but we don't teach people to do that. And you can tell because we had some really smart people who love the Lord and his church who are doing the discipleship work at South Main. But over 10 to 12 years before Matt came, we had not recruited a single new adult Sunday school teacher. And we were burning ours out. And Matt has put together a plan to double the number of teachers we have by taking them through a really intensive cohort where they go through a curriculum Truett Seminary designed for rural pastors. They're learning biblical studies and theology and church history and ethics, and they're doing some pretty extensive reading. And he pairs them with a more experienced teacher and somebody who wants to become a teacher so they can come alongside and be supported and encouraged and grow in their confidence and their competence to teach. And it's just making a world of difference. We've started new classes. Those classes are growing. I think he's making a tremendous difference in the church. Go to the next office down from Matt, and you're at Dolores. And the growth engine of our church since she's been here has been the family ministry. I don't know anyone anywhere who does a better job of asking, what am I trying to accomplish? And what things can I do that feed into accomplishing that? She's put together just an incredibly solid team for that. If you look under Dolores and that team, Amy Brown, who our youth just adore. And, you know, Amy has finished her cancer treatment. She's cancer-free. It's amazing. In April of 2022, Amy had a 14% chance of living 5 years. In December of 2022, she was cancer-free. You should give thanks to God for answers to prayer and for good doctors at MD Anderson, because that is a powerful combination. Amy is encouraging and casting a vision for our youth. Hannah Rollins has the 5th to 7th graders. She is just a Pied Piper. And sometime, ask her to show you the video of her son Harrison, who is all cowboy. And Josh, Harrison's 2. And her husband Josh had Harrison in their driveway, and he was roping a little horse that went by him. That's been watched over 1.6 million times now. I think social media is funny that way. But Hannah is passionate about our teenagers, and that tribe group are loyal to her. You may not know Jordan Anagnostopoulos, who grew up Jordan Taylor at South Main. She's doing a PhD in early childhood development, and she is the chief curriculum writer for the Sunday school that they're putting together. That from 2 years old to 12th grade, our kids are all studying the same thing each week. So if you have a 2-year-old and a 4th grader and a 5th grader, or a 5th grader, a 7th grader, and a 9th grader, when they get in the car to come home from church, they've all studied the same thing, and you can ask them about it, and they should be able to engage that text at age-appropriate levels, because they're just doing great work generating that. When we finish this build-out, I think that's going to be a marketable piece that other churches are going to want to use. Kelly Barsh continues to coordinate our child care workers and to work on the second floor, which is the elementary age. It's a great team. We're in the midst of searching for somebody to round out that team, but they're just doing incredibly good work. Next to Dolores is Adam Cogliano. Already bragged on Adam. The choir hadn't missed a beat since he's gotten here. He's introducing new repertoire to us, but I think he has a deep sense of who we are in worship and how to bring out excellence in that. Just has a giant heart. Turns out has good pipes too. So you're singing this week. He's singing next week in worship. Just really thrilled to have Adam here. You know, Thad Roberts was here 35 years. If you call a 55-year-old music minister, you don't get them for 35 years. You got to get them on the tree early and then take care of them for a long time. As incredible as Adam is, I think he's just going to keep growing and growing and growing. And we're not the only ones who've seen that. He's been asked to serve on an advisory council at Baylor to help shape the School of Church Music there. He's just a phenom. Next to Adam is Greg. What do you say about Greg? He's a poet. He's our lawyer. When we're putting together communication to the church, we call it funder words. So we'll say we need to funder word that, and ask Greg, can you help us say this in a clearer way? So when you get the budget companion, at the business meeting, that's everybody's data and everybody's story. But they're Greg's words. Greg, I think, does an incredible job tending not just your group, but the pastoral needs of the whole church, and organizing us in a way so that we're tending each other. Greg has a really strong sense. If Greg is the ministry of the church, then he can only tend one person at a time, and there's only so much Greg to go around. He's done a really great job of building systems and encouraging communities to care for each other, to extend that. He can be the minister who extends the ministry. And somehow he's done all that and published 3 books since the pandemic started. He's got 2 devotional books out, a 3rd one about to come out, and a novel that's been published. 2 novels?
No, 1 novel, working on 1, and hopefully some other things going on too.
So I'm hoping this fall we're going to give Greg time on sabbatical to get some writing projects done. He's told us a little bit about what he wants to do in that. And it's very exciting both for him and for the church. And then Brad anchors the hallway. I don't know what it is about South Maine that attracts former music ministers to be our administrators. That is a rare combination. You know, Brad's degrees are both in music education from the University of Texas. Brad is so competent and so at ease to say, I don't know that, but I'll find out. And that is confidence building in everybody who works with him. We're writing really good and really solid budgets. We're putting folks together. We're taking care of the folks who work here. Brad's just a joy to work with. I told him when he came, like, you have to be able to say no to me. And I didn't mean it quite as literally as he took it. But that keeps us on track. So that's the team I get to work with all the time. Jay Hill does missions, and that has freed Greg. Greg was doing missions and pastoral care, and either of those could be full-time. Jay's position has grown into 30 hours a week. We were together at McGregor Elementary School this morning. We have some money that we can use to help McGregor. Now, 600 students. It's the music and technology magnet. I asked the principal, what is your greatest need? You want to know what you want? Just guess what they don't have at the music and technology magnet. Instruments. She said, you know, we used to have like a $30 use fee that we could charge the kids that would sort of help us try to replenish our instruments, but we haven't been able to charge that for the last 3 years, and kids don't have instruments they can take home. Some of them are having to share instruments in class. We can fix that. We make a demonstrable difference there in addition to all the other things that are going on, but Jay coordinates that work. He goes to missions meetings across the city. He has the pulse on what all of our partners are doing and where the needs are. We've had missions in our budget, but it doesn't get on our calendar unless somebody makes that work. And Jay's been doing that. I just think doing a really fine job.
You mentioned some of the other things that you're doing with the relationships around the city. Anything else that you want to say that you're kind of working on that's in the works maybe for this year, dreaming, that sort of thing? Not that your plate's not full. It certainly is, as you've heard last hour.
No, I think one of the things that's just, I think, marvelous about South Maine is we've been invited into what is a really thorny conversation about what do we do when there are structural inequities in the city. So I've been privileged to meet with the chief of police twice a quarter just to pray for him. There are about 5 of us. It's a multi-faith group. You're never going to see it in the paper. We meet with the district attorney to do the same thing. They asked us. And that's put me in conversations with folks to ask, how can we seek the welfare of the city in which we have been planted? Because what God told Jeremiah is, as you bless the city, I'm going to bless you. And at least part of that is we get to see the world becoming a better place. I think the big work for me this year really is getting the campus master plan right. I cannot overestimate for you 100 years from now what a force for good and for gospel good that work is going to be. Imagine if we had $60 million in our foundation today. What we could do at OSA and SOZO. There's a church that inspires me is Trinity Church Wall Street. Their foundation is $8.2 billion. They got real money to work with. And they said, you know, we were started because Queen Anne gave us a piece of land, Manhattan, and said, let the income from the land fund the church. We should do that. They said, what if we bought 2,000 acres of farmland somewhere in Africa, and we use that to teach best practice farming for that region, but then we let the profits from that farm fund a church? I'd love for us to be able to do that. I'd love for us to be able to buy a hunk of land in Africa that would fund SOZO in perpetuity, or to build a training school in Peru that would fund OSA in perpetuity. And the income that we're going to generate from this campus master plan, it's silly numbers over time. But we're in the same way that I think we are stewards of gratuitous beauty here, and we want to take care of the beauty of the place, God is inviting us to be stewards of gratuitous resource and to be strategic about how we can bless not us, but how we can bless this city and our nation and the world if we'll be faithful to his purpose. And that's what I want us to dream toward.
Well, thank you. Anyone else with a question? I wanted to make sure that we covered everything, but all right. Well, Steve, thank you for being here. We'll do this again soon, and it's a joy and meaningful to work with you and work with everyone in this congregation. So thank you. It's a privilege to work with you, and thank you for answering our questions today.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right.